Cámaras, las del PAN y las del PRD y Movimiento Ciudadano, que tiene el partido tradicional de izquierda completamente desdibujado.
You're listening to Back in the USSR.
Да здравствует 60-я годовщина Великой Октябрьской социалистической революции. Да здравствует героический советский народ и его доблестные вооруженные силы. Слава Коммунистической партии Советского Союза, руководящей и направляющей силе советского общества. Ура!
Do I have the privilege of asking who's addressing me?
I'm Richard Arend.
What is your position?
I'm director of the staff. Did you file a passport application in July 2, 1954?
I filed about 25 in the last few months.
In July of 1954, were you requested to submit a non-communist affidavit?
Under no conditions would I think of signing such an affidavit. It is a contradiction of the rights of American citizens.
Are you now a member of the Communist Party?
Oh, please, please, please.
Please answer, will you, Mr. Robeson?
What is the Communist Party? What do you mean by that?
Are you now a member of the Communist Party?
Would you like
Party?
To come to the ballot box when I vote and take out the ballot and see?
Mr. Chairman, I respectfully suggest the witness be directed to answer the question. You are directed to answer the question.
I invoke the Fifth Amendment and forget it.
I respectfully suggest the witness be directed to answer the question whether, if he gave us a truthful answer, he would be supplying information which might be used against him in a criminal proceeding.
You are directed to answer,
Gentlemen,
Mr. Rutan.
In the first place, wherever I have been in the world, the first to die in the struggle against fascism were the communists. I laid many wreaths upon the graves of communists. That is not criminal. Chief Justice Warren has been very clear that the Fifth Amendment does not have anything to do with the inference of criminality, and I invoke the Fifth Amendment.
Have you ever been known under the name of John Thomas?
Oh, please, does somebody here want me to put up for perjury someplace? John Thomas, my name is Paul Robeson, and anything I have to say, I have said in public all over the world, and that is why I'm here today.
Mr. Chairman, I ask that you direct the witness to answer the question he's making a speech.
I ask you to affirm or deny the fact that your Communist Party name was John Thomas.
I invoke the Fifth Amendment. This is really ridiculous.
The witness talks very loud when he makes a speech, but when he invokes the Fifth Amendment, I can't hear him.
I have medals for diction. Right. I can talk plenty loud.
Will you talk a little louder?
I invoke the Fifth Amendment loudly.
Sir, who are Mr. and Mrs. Vladimir
Nikiev? I invoke the Fifth Amendment.
Do you know a Manning Johnson?
I invoke the Fifth Amendment.
Do you know Gregory Kifetz?
I invoke the Fifth Amendment.
Do you know a Max Juergen?
I invoke the Fifth Amendment.
Max Juergen.
Why don't you have these people here to be cross-examined? Could I ask whether this is legal?
This is not only legal, but usual. By unanimous vote, this committee has been instructed to perform this very distasteful task.
To whom am I talking?
You're speaking to the chairman of the committee.
Mr. Walter?
Yes.
The Pennsylvania Walter?
That is right.
Representative of the steel workers?
That is right.
And the coal mining workers?
That is right.
Not United States Steel, by any chance. Our great patriot?
That is right.
You are the author of the bills that are going to keep all kinds of decent people out of the country.
No, only your kind.
Colored people like myself. And you would let in the Teutonic Anglo-Saxon stock.
We are trying to make it easier to get rid of your kind, too.
You don't want any colored people to come in. Could I be allowed to read from my statement?
Will you just tell this committee, please, while under oath, Mr. Robeson, the communists who participated in the preparation of that statement?
Oh, please. The reason I'm here today, from the mouth of the State Department itself, is I should not be allowed to travel because I have struggled for the independence of the colonial peoples of Africa. The other reason I'm here today, again, from the State Department and from the record of the Court of Appeals, is that when I am abroad, I speak out against injustices against the Negro people in this land. That is why I'm here. I'm not being tried for whether I'm a communist. I'm being tried for fighting for the rights of my people, who are still second-class citizens in this country, in this United States of America. My mother was born in your state, and my mother was a Quaker. My ancestors, in the time of Washington, baked bread for George Washington's troops when they crossed the Delaware. My father was a slave. I stand here struggling for the rights of my people to be full citizens in this country, and we are not. We are not in Mississippi. They are not in Montgomery, Alabama. They are not in Washington. They are nowhere. And that is why I am here today. You want to shut up every Negro who has the courage to stand up and fight for the rights of his people, for the rights of workers. And I have been on many a picket line for the steel workers, too. And that is why I'm here today.
Would you tell us whether or not you know Thomas W. Young?
I invoke the Fifth Amendment.
Thomas W. Young is a Negro president of the Guide Publishing Company. I'd like to read you his testimony, quote, Paul Robeson has no moral right to place in jeopardy the welfare of the American Negro to advance a foreign cause. In the eyes of the Negro people, this false prophet is unfaithful to their country, and they repudiate him, close quote. Do you know the man that said that?
I invoke the Fifth Amendment now. Can I read my statement? It is a sad and bitter commentary.
While you were in Paris in 1949, Mr. Robeson, did you tell an audience the American Negro would never go to war against the Soviet government?
May I say that is slightly out of context. May I explain to you what I did say? I remember the speech very well. 2,000 students who came from populations that would range to 600 or 700 million people asked me to say in their name that they did not want war. No part of my speech in Paris says 15 million American Negroes would do anything. I said it was my feeling that the American people would struggle for peace, and that has been since underscored by the President of these United States. Now, in passing, I said...
Any people who want war?
Listen to me. I said it was unthinkable to me that any people could take up arms in the name of a man like Senator Eastland of Mississippi against anybody. Gentlemen, I still say that. This United States government should go to Mississippi and protect my people. That is what it should do.
I lay before you, sir, an article. Quote, I am looking for full freedom, unquote, by Paul Robeson in The Worker. July 3rd, 1949, quote, I said it was unthinkable that the Negro people of America or elsewhere could be drawn into war with the Soviet Union. I repeat it with a hundredfold emphasis, they will not, close quote.
And, gentlemen, they have not. It is clear that no Americans are going to go to war with the Soviet Union.
While you were in Stockholm, did you make a little speech?
I made all kinds of speeches.
Let me read you a quotation.
Let me listen.
Do so, please.
I am a lawyer.
It would be a revelation if you would listen to counsel.
In good company, I usually listen. But you know, people wander around in such fancy places.
You said, Mr. Robeson, and I quote, I belong to the American resistance movement, which fights against American imperialism, just as the resistance movement fought against Hitler.
Just like Frederick Douglass and Harriet Tubman were underground railroaders and fighting for our freedom, you bet your life.
I have to insist that you listen to these questions.
I am listening.
I quote further, why should the Negroes ever fight against the only nation in the world where racial discrimination is prohibited and where the people can live freely? Never. They will never fight against either the Soviet Union or the people's democracies, close quote. Did you make that statement?
I do not remember, but what is perfectly clear today is that 900 million people, other colored people, have told you they will not. 400 million in India and millions everywhere have told you
that.
The
witness has answered the question. He doesn't need to make a speech.
Did you write an article that was published in the USSR Information Bulletin?
Yes.
Quote, I want to emphasize that only here in the Soviet Union did I feel that I was a real man with a capital M, close quote.
I would say, what is your name?
Errant.
I am quite willing to answer the question. When I was a singer years ago, and this you will have to listen to.
I am listening.
I am a bass singer, so for me, it was Chelyapin, the great Russian bass, not Caruso the tenor. I learned the Russian language to sing their songs. I wish you would listen now.
Mr. Chairman, I ask you to direct the witness to answer the question.
Just be fair with me.
I ask for order.
The great poet of Russia is of African blood.
Well, let's not go so far afield.
It is important to explain this.
Did you make that statement?
When I first went to Russia in 1934...
Did you make that statement?
When I first went to Russia in 1934...
Did you make that statement?
In Russia, I felt for the first time like a full human being. No color prejudice like in Mississippi. No color prejudice like in Washington. It was the first time I felt like a human being. Well, I do not feel the pressure of color as I feel it in this committee today.
Why do you not stay in Russia?
Because my father was a slave, and my people died to build this country. And I'm going to stay here and have a part of it just like you, and no fascist-minded people will drive me from it. Is that clear?
You are here because you are promoting the communist cause.
I am here because I'm opposing the neo-fascist cause, which I see arising in these committees. Jefferson could be sitting here, and Frederick Douglass could be sitting here. Eugene Debs could be sitting here.
Now, what prejudice are you talking about? You were graduated from Rutgers. You were graduated from the University of Pennsylvania. I remember seeing you play football at Lehigh. There was no prejudice against you.
Just a moment. This is something I challenge very deeply, that the success of a few Negroes can make up for $700 a year for thousands of Negro families in the South. My father was a slave, and I have cousins who are sharecroppers. I do not see success in terms of myself. I have sacrificed hundreds of thousands of dollars for what I believe in.
While you were in Moscow, Mr. Robeson, did you make a speech lauding Stalin?
I can't remember.
Have you recently changed your mind about Stalin?
What has happened to Stalin, gentlemen, is a question for the Soviet Union, and I won't argue with a representative of the people who, in building America,
wasted the lives of my people. You are responsible, you and your forebears, for 60 to 100 million black people dying in the slave ships and on the plantations. Mm-hmm. Don't you ask me about anybody.
I'm sure you wouldn't want to discuss with us the slave labor camps in the Soviet Union.
Nothing could be built more on slavery than this society, I assure you.
I would invite your attention to the Daily Worker of June 29, 1949, with reference to a get-together with you and Ben Davis, formerly communist councilman in New York. Do you know Ben
Davis?
One
of my dearest friends. He is as patriotic an American as can be. And you, gentlemen, are the non-patriots.
Just a minute.
You are the un-American.
The hearing is now adjourned.
I think it should be.
I've endured all of this that I can.
Can I read my statement?
No! The meeting is adjourned.
It should be.
Just going home.
You're listening to Back in the USSR on CFRU 93.3 FM. I am Siegfried. This is Black History Month, the final episode of a series of shows that I've been doing on the struggle of African Americans for liberation and self-determination. That, of course, was Paul Robeson with his version of the iconic song Going Home. And, of course, we also heard his speech before the House Committee on Un-American Activities. And, of course, this struggle for African Americans for liberation and self-determination was a struggle that Paul Robeson, the famous African American singer, actor, activist, and communist, was very much a part of when he spoke between the frankly racist anti-communist bigots populating the House Committee on Un-American Activities in the 1950s, at a time when Jim Crow was still very much reigning in the United States. And as we continue to move forward in a 21st century North America where systemic racism, police brutality, far-right fascist violence, capitalist plunder, and imperialist war remain on the march, I firmly believe that those African Americans who gave their lives for the liberation of working class, colonized, and oppressed peoples of the world have the right to be remembered. Paul Robeson is one such man. W.E.B. Du Bois is another. Langston Hughes. All of them saw the liberation of their people, in which Paul Robeson spoke so eloquently about in that speech I just played. They saw the liberation of their people as being inextricably bound up with the liberation of oppressed peoples the world over, just as Malcolm X and the Black Panthers ultimately did, and just as Black Lives Matter is rediscovering today, when they came to the conclusion that simply having a black figurehead in the White House, when they came to the conclusion that that would not protect ordinary black people from being murdered in the streets by cops. After 6 years of broken promises, they were cruelly reminded of the bitter truth that they, as a people, had not been integrated into some kind of post-racial situation, as Obama and the liberal media had promised, but in fact remained colonized by an American society that was and is every bit as brutal and racist as the American society that murdered Fred Hampton and the other leaders of the Black Power movement in the 1960s. The uprising in Ferguson, Missouri, in particular, revealed that black people, especially working-class black people, were effectively in the same boat as the Palestinians. And then, as we know, Donald Trump came along and sealed the deal, tore the mask off, as it were, exposing America once more as the monster that it was and has been all along. Tonight, on my final show of Black History Month, I'm going to talk about two lesser-known African-Americans who you probably won't hear about, well, you definitely won't hear about in school. In the current witch hunt atmosphere in America today, you know, surrounding Russiagate and all that nonsense, both these men would most likely be demonized as traitors and foreign agents, just as Paul Robeson was in his own time, simply because they were communists. But Harry Haywood and Oliver Law, the two men I'm going to talk about here tonight, would no doubt smile at this slander and laugh, for both of them knew what they were fighting for. They knew what they were fighting for. They were communists, black Bolsheviks, internationalists, and they were fighting for the liberation of their people, just as they were fighting for the liberation of all the wretched of the earth, for the liberation of all the colonized and oppressed peoples of the earth. And they understood how it was all connected. Now I'm going to start with Harry Haywood. Now Harry Haywood, he was a longtime member and leader of the Communist Party USA and other communist organizations from the 1920s until his death in 1985. He was the key figure in developing and popularizing the concept that blacks represented a separate nation inside the United States. While Haywood gets almost no mention in many accounts of black history, his theoretical innovations probably did more than any other one individual to frame the terms of the debate about the historical character of the black community. The Black Belt thesis established the oppression of African Americans as a national question, of utmost importance for revolutionaries in the United States. Utmost importance for them to address. What became known as the Black Belt thesis had its roots in the conception of black Americans initially conceived by Haywood and other communists of various nationalities in the Communist International. That being the world communist organization that existed, beginning with the Third International in the Soviet Union in the 1920s and going through the 1930s, unifying the struggles of all the communists in the world. So the Black Belt thesis that Haywood developed through the Communist International, basing itself on the conceptions developed by Lenin and grounded in the Soviet experience with oppressed nations, this theory held blacks in America made up not simply a racial or ethnic group or a minority, but comprised an oppressed nation. And the thesis was adopted at the 6th Congress of the Communist International under Stalin's leadership in 1928. This conception did not mean nation in the sense of the nation-state, as today's common usage would suggest, but rather had its roots in the conception, in the concept of how nation-states were formed by capitalism. As feudalism gave way to capitalism, the new social system smashed the barriers of innumerable fiefdoms, and through a long process of war and market growth took people of different historical backgrounds and across relatively large areas and molded them into one people, with a common language, national market, culture, etc. Each nation-state that developed in this way, the most common examples in this process being Western European countries such as France and England, had a unique historical development. Lenin's traditional conception had held that multinational states appeared in countries where the process of capitalist development had been uneven, where non-capitalist or semi-capitalist economic forms played major roles economically and socially. This held true for the Tsarist Russian Empire, where the Romanov monarchs sought to introduce advanced capitalism without making any changes to the country's feudal character. Russia thus created a fusion of the most advanced capitalist methods alongside the social structure and agricultural life of the 13th century. This historical unevenness created a multinational nation-state spanning an entire continent, involving over 100 different distinct nationalities and ethnicities. Haywood saw a similarity in the situation of African Americans. Although brought to America from many different ethnicities and cultures in Africa, the unique experience of slavery over time forged Africans into a new distinct people in the Western Hemisphere. For Haywood, this was not only a cultural phenomenon in which blacks developed a common identity based on their common experiences and struggles, but also had a geographic basis. The transformation of Africans of disparate backgrounds into a common African-American nation occurred over a defined land base in the Deep South, where blacks maintained a majority of the populace, and still do today in many cases. After the overthrow of Reconstruction, debt peonage in the South and the Jim Crow system further ingrained the super-exploitation of blacks in the Black Belt South as a dominant and enduring feature of U.S. capitalism. The region in question, Haywood argued, in fact represented an internal colony. What followed from this was the notion that if blacks made up a nation within the United States, they also had the right to self-determination, which of course was going to become crucial to the ideas of the Black Panthers, the ideas of Malcolm X and the Black Power movement in general further down the line in the 1960s, 70s. Harry Haywood did not develop his theoretical conceptions on the Black nation out of any desire for Black separatism. He was totally committed to the idea of a united working class party. However, he realized only a party that bases itself on the life and death struggle against white supremacy could overcome the obstacles to class unity in America. Such a struggle was necessary to earn the trust of the black masses on one hand and to break white workers away from ruling class ideology on the other. While black communists collaborated with all sorts of other forces in the mass struggle, Haywood made a clear distinction about the program of communists. The communist efforts to win working class leadership of the black liberation struggle and their advocacy for socialism as the only resolution to national oppression brought them into conflict with bourgeois black leaders of both the integrationist and nationalist type. Haywood subjected both the bourgeois integrationist trend and the nationalist trend in the 1930s black community to a class analysis. The integrationist NAACP and the Urban League, represented by successful businessmen, top echelon leaders, upper bracket educators, and local politicians, typically commanded leadership of the black movement due to their deep linkages to Wall Street and white philanthropic organizations. On the other hand, the nationalists were rooted in the black ghettos, among small businessmen, the intelligentsia professionals, and the like, and expressed the desires of the black petite bourgeoisie, stunted by modern imperialism, to control the economic life of black urban communities. In conditions of crisis especially, Haywood noted, the nationalists' appeal to race solidarity or Back to Africa programs had the capability of attracting large sections of the black poor, for whom the integrationists provided no economic answers. Haywood asserted that it was necessary for communists to recognize the anti-imperialist revolutionary potential and historical legitimacy of the black nationalist movement. At the same time, Haywood warned the party that the militancy of this petty bourgeois stratum is very misleading, and repeatedly pushed the party not to make the opposite mistake of surrendering to the propaganda of local nationalists. Haywood's point is further reinforced by the fact that the black capitalist schemes have on several occasions found support among the most reactionary elements of the white community, from the Ku Klux Klan to Richard Nixon, who proclaimed in 1968 that many black militants merely wanted a piece of the action rather than overturning of the social system. One good example of Haywood's departure from petty bourgeois black nationalism is in the "Don't Buy Where You Don't Work, Where You Can't Work" campaigns of the 1930s, which took root in Harlem, Baltimore, Washington, D.C., and elsewhere. These campaigns, led by local black nationalists who shunned work with whites, took aim at the white-owned stores that excluded blacks from employment while selling products in the ghetto. Nationalist leaders called for the white employees to be replaced by black employees at the targeted stores, a demand that quickly developed a significant following. Haywood knew that the campaigns thrived on the justly felt anger of the black working class, but argued that the ruling class was overjoyed with this type of movement because it blurred the class line and tended to quickly become anti-white. They directed the struggle against those small establishments which had only a small fraction of jobs, as well as white workers, and thus the broad struggle of the black unemployed was diverted away from the large corporations located mostly outside the ghetto. Haywood argued that the Communist Party could not stand aloof from this struggle for black jobs, instead calling for the party to focus on a broader campaign spearheaded by black and white unionists, which did not call for the firing of any existing workers. Haywood's tactics always started with the party's strategic outlook, building black-white unity in the fight against both national and class oppression. Indeed, Haywood devoted a good deal of his political energies, as well as his later autobiography, to this fundamental question facing revolutionaries in the United States. Building class unity has never been an easy task. For one, white supremacy has long functioned as an unofficial state religion in America. Secondly, black people in the United States face special oppression above and beyond the normal forms of oppression meted out by the capitalist society. And the resistance to these forms of oppression must take a unique form. Finally, looking over the country's history, a pattern emerges in which black people surge forward in struggle, become the engine for radicalism in society as a whole, but are crushed by the combined forces of the ruling class before a sizable enough section of white workers recognize their common interests with the black freedom movement. Liberals and nationalists tend to accept this pattern as inevitable and irreversible, but draw opposite conclusions. Either that black people should go slow and not demand so much, which is the liberal argument, or that black people should focus on carving out spaces or states independent of the existing social order, the nationalist argument. Revolutionary Marxists support the right of self-determination, but also propose a different solution to the uneven development of political consciousness among different sectors. They propose a fighting organization that has fused together the workers leading in each sector, and that maintains a significant influence in each and frames tactics that promote the common benefit of class struggle and black liberation at the same time. Pushing for working class revolution and black liberation at the same time. This perspective of promoting multinational unity is easy to uphold on paper, but must be fought for in practice. Stirring up racism among white workers has long been the most powerful weapon in the ruling class arsenal. Further, Haywood recognized that nationalist sentiments of the black working class inevitably would find some expression within the Communist Party, a phenomenon that he warned against most emphatically in the party's 1934 convention. Haywood wrote, "Just as the ruling class ideology of white supremacy has had its influences on white comrades, it was not unusual that black comrades would similarly be affected by petty bourgeois nationalist ideology. These moods were and sentiments were expressed in feelings of distrust of white comrades, in skepticism about the possibility of winning white workers to active support in the struggle for black rights, and in the attitude that nothing could be accomplished until white chauvinism was completely eliminated. This latter was particularly dangerous because it failed to understand that white chauvinism could only be broken down in the process of class struggle." Haywood recognized that multinational unity in a society like America is not a feel-good exercise or simply a helpful secondary factor. Rather, a united working class is the only road to an overthrow of capitalism, which holds the only chance for the full liberation of the mass of black workers, who constitute the vast majority of blacks in America. This is a legacy left to us by Harry Haywood, a critical and uncompromising dedication to the total liberation of black workers, the working class, and humanity itself.
So read the Communist Manifesto. Guerrillas in the mix of Guevara and Manesto. So
what a brother with an afro now.
Yo, go a flow for the Mac and we the hoes. So grow, cause the Lucian brothers might get hung. Rhetoric flowing from the tip of my mouth. Say tongue deficit.
Money spent.
Catch the glint.
On my 9 as they cut welfare 25%.
And I dissent as I clinch and raise my
we
fist.
We did away with that.
So you could get with this. It's a twist cause we'll overthrow like Kwame Nkrumah. Spread around the world as if it were a business rumor. Bam, bam. Cuts a record like a surgeon cuts a tumor from a brain.
We're all cooped up, so fill the tank.
From 400 years of exploitation, anesthesia provided by your local TV station. Patience is not a virtue.
I ain't waiting.
Turn this shit over like Bush did a boatload of hate. In a dog pound like H-Rap Brown with the situation.
Won't be no calluses,
cause we're spitting dialectical analysis. So how is this we never had no funk? Until you found out that our trunks are revolutionary, huh?
Chuck.
Bump you over like dominoes, rat.
So free Geronimo, you jack a prick.
Lyrics, hear it, lyric, can't get near it. Got a sample, didn't clear it. Point blank says, fuck 5-0, that's the spirit. Cheer it. Spat out the fact that I consumed, knew that I was doomed since my date of birth to be the wretched of the earth. Never had a dream that was American.
They go to like the Cherokee.
Disparaging.
But that ain't nothing new.
Told the streets where paper go, whoever paved that shit got minimum wage too.
Do you understand the metaphor? Exploited and they hung us. I'd like to take a moment to say fuck Columbus.
Millions off my back.
Black on black crisis is a myth. The crack that did the
What's
damage.
What's the one from the whip?
The record skip. The record skip. The record skip. The record skips cause my voice is kinda scratchy from yelling don't you when 5-0 comes to harass me. They never pass me, no one to go and tell, bro.
Trying to kill the movement with the new COINTEL, bro.
Leaders they kill, if I said it, it was granted them. They only see my back because I'm 3 steps ahead of them. We're not falling in the slot, just slated.
We realize that our power is nickel plated.
Masses move as well as asses do. Class is through, our time is over, past us due.
And you still wanna know
the origin of the flow. Oakland, California, now for 6-1 up.
Yeah,
and we out, y'all.
Listening to Back in the USSR here on 93.3 FM CFRU. That was The Coup with Dig It. And just before that song, of course, we're talking about Harry Haywood and his role in formulating the, you know, the concept, the understanding, you know, African Americans constituted a distinct nation within North American society that had been colonized and oppressed. And they were not simply a minority or ethnicity. They actually constituted a nation. And that this, the liberation of this nation, you know, from racism, from oppression, from segregation, from like all the forces that were oppressing them in American society, that had to go hand in hand with working class revolution, with socialism. And Harry Haywood, of course, he was a communist. He was a member of the Communist Party. He'd been to the Soviet Union a number of times. He traveled there, you know, and when he went there, he experienced what it was like to live in a society that did not have segregation, that did not have anti-black racism, where he did not experience those things. And it had a very, very profound effect on him. You know, as it did on Paul Robeson and other people and many other African-Americans who actually traveled to the Soviet Union, to socialist countries at that time, and who later... You know, and of course, during later on, during the 60s and the 70s, when you actually had members of the Black Panther Party going to China, going to Cuba, going to all these other, to Vietnam, to all these places where socialism was being built and where formerly colonized peoples were building whole new nations and new societies and liberating themselves from colonial oppression. You know, they identified with that. They identified with that. They expressed solidarity with that. They built strong bonds of friendship with those forces and those movements. And they linked those movements with the struggles of African Americans inside the United States and their struggles for liberation. And that internationalism there has historically been very important in the African American liberation struggle. And of course, right now I want to talk about the other person I was going to talk about, the other African American who you will not hear about in school, and that is Oliver Law. Now, Oliver Law, he was also a communist, he was a labor organizer, and he was the first black person in the United States to lead an integrated military force in the country's history. You know, so a military force where white and black Americans basically were fighting side by side in the same military units. Now, unlike Harry Haywood, he was not a theorist, but like him, he was a fighter. He had joined the U.S. Army in 1919, but he wouldn't last very, very long in that, you know, say, deeply racist organization. and he would leave it, and he would ultimately join the Communist Party in 1932. And his work with them, as well as his political activities through the International Labor Defense Organization, kept the cops constantly on his coattails. I mean, he was constantly followed, constantly harassed. And in one incident, the Chicago Police Red Squad, you know, political police force, basically set up to specifically target trade unionists, labor leaders, and communists, severely assaulted him, like beat him up in the street. And in another incident, Law was arrested while speaking at a demonstration in Chicago on August 31st, 1935, against Italy's occupation of Ethiopia, fascist Italy's occupation of Ethiopia, during the Second Italo-Abyssinian War, which was one of the events that really paved the way for World War II. It was a milestone for the rising tide of fascism, the very dangerous rising tide of fascism in the 1930s. And he was organizing organizing mass protests against that occupation. And seeing he was very, very dedicated to the fight against fascism, you know, the international fight against fascism, it's no surprise that a year later, Law actually, he joined the Abraham Lincoln Brigade, you know, and the thousands of international volunteers who traveled from America to Spain to fight against Spain's dictator Francisco Franco, and who of course was backed by Hitler and Mussolini, and who was attempting to overthrow the legitimate government, progressive Spanish Republican government, in a right-wing coup d'etat. And of course, there were 15 international brigades. People came from all around the world to fight against fascism in Spain. So fighting alongside the Republic in the Spanish Civil War. And these, of course, were people from all ethnicities. I mean, there were people coming from, you know, there were black people, there were white people, there were people coming from Asia, there were people coming from China. You know, the people came from all over the world to fight against fascism in Spain in the 1930s, in the Spanish Civil War. So fighting alongside the Republic, the Spanish Republic, in the Spanish Civil War against fascism. And of course, the Spanish Civil War occurred between July 1936 and April 1939. And during this struggle, Law was named commander of the entire Abraham Lincoln Brigade for several days, and commander of its machine gun regiment for much longer. So this man, a black man from a deeply segregated American society, became the leader of this entire combat unit, consisting not only of black men, but white men and people from all ethnicities. You had a black man leading that unit. And that was for the first time ever you had anything like that happen in American history. And Law, he led the brigade during the initial days of the Brunette Offensive against the fascist forces, but on the fourth day of the campaign, he was fatally wounded while leading his command in an assault on Mosquito Ridge, which I believe is not far from Madrid. And 5 decades after his death, took 5 decades, Law's historical achievement as the leader of the Abraham Lincoln Brigade was recognized when Chicago Mayor Harold Washington declared November 21st, 1987, as the Oliver Law and Abraham Lincoln Day, Abraham Lincoln Brigade Day in that city. So here was a real African-American hero who was, you know, virtually unheard of by most people. You know, a real internationalist who went and fought against fascism in Spain, commanded the first integrated military unit in American history. You know, it was a committed communist, committed fighter against oppression everywhere in the world, against national oppression, against colonialism, against exploitation. And he was willing to go to another country and fight alongside its people to resist fascism. And he gave his life for that, alongside many, many hundreds of other Americans, many thousands of other international volunteers who came from many, many different countries during that decade. And that definitely is something worth remembering. These heroes are definitely worth remembering and commemorating. And that is something that really we need to see more of. So Oliver Law, just like Yuri Heywood, definitely a hero. Please stay tuned to Back in the USSR.
From the farms, from the cities, from every land came the Abe Lincoln Brigade. With a dream in their hearts and a gun in their hands, the Abraham Lincoln Brigade. No passeran, no passeran, so sang the Abe Lincoln Brigade. Across the years and the oceans, we still sing the song of the Abraham Lincoln Brigade. Cries from the cities, shouts from the hills of the Abraham Lincoln Brigade. The fire in the hearts that is warming us still, the Abraham Lincoln Brigade. No passeran, no passeran, so sang the Abe Lincoln Brigade. Across the years and the oceans, we still sing the song of the Abraham Lincoln Brigade. Lincoln Brigade. Their stories still thrill me. We work side by side with the Abraham Lincoln Brigade. No passeran, no passeran, so sang the Abe Lincoln Brigade. Across the years and the oceans, we still sing the song of the Abraham Lincoln Brigade. So raise glasses and voices, give them a toast, oh, the Abe Lincoln Brigade. Those who die best are the ones who live most, like the Abraham Lincoln Brigade. No passeran, no passeran, so sang the Abe Lincoln Brigade. Across the years and the oceans, we still sing the song of the Abraham Lincoln Brigade. No passeran, no passeran, so sang the Abe Lincoln Brigade. Across the years and the oceans, still sing the song of the Abraham Lincoln Brigade.
Back in the USSR, we'll be back after this short break.
I'm listening to CFRU 93.3 FM right now.
CFRU, the Central Student Association, and the Downtown Guelph Business Association are thrilled to present Eloquent, Sensi Boy, and O'Buxom at the Red Papaya on Sunday, February 25th. Join us for a family-friendly afternoon of hip-hop and rap as part of Downtown Guelph's Music Weekend series. Doors are at 2 p.m., and it's all ages and pay what you can. That's Eloquent, Sensi Boy, and Obuxum at the Red Papaya, 55 Wyndham Street North in the Old Quebec Street Mall on Sunday, February 25th.
Magic here every Saturday afternoon on CFRU. Seriously, music.
Bracelet of Hope will be holding their third annual Yoga for Hope Yogathon event on Saturday, March 3rd from 10 a.m. to 3:30 p.m. at the Frank Hasenfratz Center of Excellence. Registration is $30, which includes five classes plus lunch from Zoop, TRY vegan desserts, meditations, and a goodie bag. Yoga for Hope is for participants of all shapes, sizes, and experiences. Join for one class or all five. Bracelet of Hope is a grassroots Guelph-based charity committed to supporting the three pillars of health, homes, and jobs in a collaborative effort with the people of Lesotho, Africa. To register for Yoga for Hope, visit braceletofhope.ca/yogathon. The third annual Yoga for Hope will once again be taking place at the Frank Hasenfratz Center of Excellence, 700 Woodlawn Road West, a physically accessible location on March 3rd.
Listen to Back in the USSR here on 93.3 FM CFRU. So for the break there, we had the Abraham Lincoln Brigade, sung by John McCutcheon, singing about Oliver Law's old military unit in the Spanish Civil War. You know, the volunteers who came from the United States to fight, both black and white, people of all ethnicities coming together to fight against fascism in Spain, as did people from all over the world. At that time, of course, you had the Mackenzie Papineau Brigade coming in from Canada at that time. Now, what I want to play right now, because, of course, I've been talking mainly, I've talked about Oliver Law, I've talked about Harry Haywood, all these, you know, at the beginning, we talked about Paul Robeson, all these African-Americans who were true internationalists. Like, they were people who were building solidarity between their people and peoples fighting for liberation all over the world. You know, and they were connecting those, the struggle of their people with those anti-colonial struggles, anti-imperialist struggles all over the world. This is what they were doing. And there's a very real tradition in the African-American struggle for liberation that is internationalist. And in fact, as the next, as the person who's going to be speaking on this in this next clip I'm going to play, really emphasizes the major gains. Like the period where the periods of time when African Americans really won the greatest gains in their struggle for liberation, equal rights, self-determination, these kind of things, they've always been when they've African Americans have linked their struggles with the struggles of people in other countries, when there's really been international solidarity with African Americans. You know, where African Americans are not alone. They know they're not alone. They're together with people all over the world struggling against colonialism, against oppression, against racism. And these are the times when the greatest gains have been made. You know, in periods like such as the 1960s. You know, when there was definitely major international pressure on the United States to really, you know, break down segregation. You know, and there's a whole international movement against segregation and against like the apartheid that existed in America at that time, you know, and this sort of stuff. Like this was a, and there was a lot of international solidarity, a lot of international support for African Americans.